All right. Well, hello and welcome once again to the Wednesday edition of American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, here every Wednesday and Friday at 5 p.m. Heidi Morales, my lovely wife and co-host here as well.
I am here, always by your side.
I'm glad for that. Today we're going to do something a little bit different, unusual. As you know, we usually do these like anniversary-type shows on Wednesdays where we celebrate the music of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, whatever the case may be. And it turns out that 40 years ago in this month, in October, one of my favorite albums of all time was released. It was called Quadrophenia.
Yay.
By The Who. And I still love the album as now as much as I loved it when it came out then. I remember I got it for Christmas in December of 1973. I've got my own personal stories about this, but what's going to make the show a little bit unusual, besides dedicating the show to one album exclusively, we also have a special guest in the studio, a friend of the show's, actually, I believe a longtime listener as well, and he has written a book called When Stars Were in Reach, which is a book essentially about The Who. And I'll just leave that at that. Let me introduce Michael Rosenblum to our program. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you here. I know we've more or less chatted a couple of times back and forth, whether it was email or you commenting on some of the things that have happened on our program in the past.
I love the show. It's a privilege to be here. It's for me, it's the best show on terrestrial radio.
On terrestrial? That's saying something. Thank you very, very much. Well, you know, we do something that's different because we don't have to worry about following rules, and commercial radio has got so many things that make it difficult.
It's the only show where I could possibly hear my Little Red Book by Love. Nowhere else.
Oh, yeah.
or maybe even deeper cuts by Love as well. It's true. Well, you got in touch with me a while back because you had written your own book. And I remember you sent me a copy, and I guess I must have had this for about 5 or 6 months. And we both had the brainstorm that what we really should do is do this with, I might have even been your idea, about trying to do this in conjunction with celebrating, you know, the anniversary for Quadrophenia. What is really interesting about the book to me, now the full title is When Stars Were in Reach, The Who at Union Catholic High School, November 29, 1967. It's a piece of history where we're actually talking about The Who playing in a high school gymnasium.
In a Catholic high school gymnasium.
At that. Tell us how you came about this story, first of all.
First of all, I stumbled onto the story. I went down to my basement by chance and found an old bin with some rock memorabilia, some Who concert posters, some Fillmore East programs. And I said, you know, this paper is not going to last forever. I'm not a curator. And, you know, my wife was not born in this country. She really doesn't share my love for this kind of music. My daughters, I never pushed my musical tastes onto them. So I figured once I'm gone, this stuff may even be thrown out.
I think this all the time myself, by the way. I'm in the exact same boat as you.
And I know some of this stuff had some value. So I sold two Who concert posters on eBay. One from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, from I think it was November of 1972 or 71. And I got great money for it. So I sold another one. I had this crumbling poster from The Who at Stony Brook, October 1973. And the same guy that bought the poster wanted those pieces to put together. He gave it, he ended up giving it to a curator in Spain.
Huh. Wow.
Who
reconstructed it.
Reconstructed the poster. Subsequent to that, he sent me an email with different pictures of Who concert posters from the New York area. And one of them was this concert poster of The Who at Union Catholic High School from 1967.
Which is the cover of the book.
Which is the cover of the book, right. And I immediately was smitten. I had been out of the loop for a while. I still loved their music, but I completely left memorabilia collecting. And I said, you know what? This is a great vehicle to put the first third of my life into context, because I was a big Who fan. I mean, traveled, you know, the length of the Eastern Seaboard from Montreal to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, seeing, you know, a lot of Who shows. And I also, it was also a fitting way to pay tribute to this band that, that I love so much.
Now, you were an old, were you a fan at that time?
I mean, I started getting into The Who in 1967.
Through The Who sellout, I presume?
Well, a friend turned me on to it. The Who sellout had not yet been released because that was released in England only in December of 67. So I would say through Happy Jack was the first album.
Right, the American album.
The American,
album,
right? Yeah.
And that's early. That's early. There were not very many Who fans at that point.
That's correct. There were not many Who fans at that time. And I remember The Who. I remember seeing The Who on the Smothers Brothers TV show.
When the explosive went off.
Right, in October of 1967. So, yeah, you know. And Who fans always have a certain ranking system of how early you got into them. Like the ones with the most prestige are the ones who got into them at the time of the Murray the K Show, their first American performance in March of 67. And
it sounds like you're very close to that, though.
I mean, not far.
If it's a scale of 1 to 10, you're certainly at 10 in my book. I don't remember even knowing if I knew who the Who were until I Can See for Miles was on the radio,
right.
And that I think that was the first top 40 hit, if I recall, which is incredible. They missed the entire British invasion. It's so weird because I think they got associated with the British invasion.
They had their own invasion.
Yeah, they were way subsequent to it.
Yeah, there are a few oddities about them. One of them being that in Britain they were a singles band, and they only had one top 10 hit throughout their career, and that was I Can See for Miles, and it only reached number 9, and only nationally.
Right.
In New York, I don't think it may have reached 16 or 23. I don't remember the exact number. So in the U.S. they were an album band. Totally an album band.
Absolutely.
Never a singles band.
Absolutely.
Well, you've gone over that on your show, you know.
Yeah. Townsend basically needs, you know, some sort of a theme in order to write with. And that's one of the things that I always say about him. He definitely a person who loves to have some sort of structure in which he can create his ideas. Because if they don't fit into some format, he doesn't just write individual songs. He writes entire novels and plays and rock operas right from that album in 67, The Who Sell Out.
Right.
You know, to stay on topic with what I want to do is talking with you and with playing the album. Let's play a track from Quadrophenia. Let's hear a song, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about the book.
Sure.
This is, I think, the first song with lyrics on the album. This is called The Real Me.
Can you see the real me?
You know, I there's so many albums that could qualify as my favorite Who album. Who's Next is a brilliant record. And of course, so many people would want to pick Tommy. Who Sell Out, because it's such a cool, crazy record. But I think Quadrophenia is my ultimately my favorite album. And it's great to hear it. And I don't play it often enough. I got the vinyl copy here in front of me, which is kind of fun. I'm sure you had the vinyl copy yourself, Michael.
Oh, yeah. I have from several countries.
Really?
Wow, now, completist.
Not a completist, but towards that end.
Now, Heidi and I, of course, are sitting here with Michael Rosenblum, the author of When Stars Were in Reach. This book all about how The Who managed to appear at a New Jersey high school, Union Catholic High School, to be specific, on November 29th, 1967. Now, I think we made the point that you didn't go to the high school, but you found out about the story through this poster.
Right.
Now, you had to, it inspired you enough to decide to write this story, like you said, to more or less tell about your passion for the first third of your life, I guess is how you were putting it, right?
Right. The book is really three stories interwoven. The main story is the story of the Who at Union Catholic High School. And another side story is the story of the four 15-year-old kids who ended up helping the Who's roadies with their equipment after the show. And the third story that's interwoven into both of them is my own coming-of-age story, which revolves around the Who.
Right. Now, with you coming of age, and I guess this is what, like I said, inspiring you to write the book, when you saw this, and you were probably at the perfect age, you're a teenager, you were probably high school age.
Yeah, I was 14.
Yeah, I was actually, even reading the book, I was totally fooled into thinking that you were probably there and with these kids and that you were somehow basically writing it around that experience. So what you had to do, since you were not there, you had to basically find all these people. I mean, that must have been really strange. You're finding all of the teachers, some of the students who were there. How did that come about? How did you begin it?
First of all, that was one of the most exciting parts of the whole process, was tracking down these people. The first thing I said was, you know, with the internet, with Facebook, with Google, and the high school is in the New York metropolitan area, I bet you I can track down a number of these people, and I better do so quickly because
time's passing.
Yeah, time is passing. As a matter of fact, you know, two of the people who I wrote about in this book, two of the faculty members have since passed away since I wrote the book. Yeah.
Wow.
So the first thing I did was I did a Google search, and I found a reference to the concert on a Who website. Written by one of the four 15-year-old kids.
Awesome.
About the equipment. These kids ended up becoming real techies, knowledgeable about PA systems, instruments, everything having to do with the electronic side of it. And I drove out to New Jersey and interviewed like five of them, four plus a friend that was at the show I had a fantastic interview with them, and that spurred me then to write an email to the school, to the alumni relations at Union Catholic High School, saying, and I was really presumptuous. I said something like, I'm writing a book. I mean, I just had one interview. It was like I was back. It was like back to Who collecting, where you would say the most outrageous things to sound believable so that you'd somehow come out of it with like a rare poster or something.
Well, you've got to have an end game in mind, right? So,
right.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure I did the exact same thing. I mean, when you're writing a book, you don't know that it's going to be what it is, but you at some point you make up your mind. I'm going to do this.
But it could have been just a magazine article, but I said, no, it's going to be a book. And I just put one foot in front of the other until it, you know, the book basically wrote itself. But going back to fine tracking all these characters, so I sent an email to the director of alumni relations. She then sent an email to the alumni of that era, saying someone's writing a book, and they'd like to interview you and hear your memories. That then spurred a flurry of emails to me.
So you basically the whole class, in other words,
right,
that were available, were now privy to you.
Yeah, it wasn't just that class. It was the four years of classes that were in the school at the time. From the class of 67, 68 class to the class of 70, 71.
I should mention at this point, too, that throughout the book, you've got photos sometimes of the very cast members that you're talking about. And, you know, like you talk about like the jukebox that was playing The Who in the cafeteria. You've actually got a picture of the jukebox and some of the students standing around the jukebox. All these, I guess you'd say, like vintage photos from that time and that era.
Right, the girls with their saddle shoes on.
Yeah,
and I actually had to do research about jukeboxes so that I would be knowledgeable enough to write a chapter about it. and so students wrote me. I started interviewing them. I taped them. I then transcribed them so I would be able to access their words. I then tracked down the opening act. I tracked down I interviewed 4/5 of the opening act, the Decoys.
That's a fascinating part. So you found the band, which was essentially just a bunch of guys that went to that school.
One of them went to the school.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
One of them. And he was the key figure in the eventual booking of The Who, because he somehow knew a booking agent, or his father knew a producer, and he's the one that somehow got The Who hooked up with Union Catholic High School. And then I tracked down three of the faculty, and I even tracked down the booking agent, who ended up being, when I interviewed her, she was a 92-year-old woman.
And that was, yes, I remember reading the chapter about it. She's in Florida now, apparently.
She's in Florida. I mean, I think she's still living, because every now and then I Google her to see if there's an obit, and she's 96 years old,
still working.
And it was amazing speaking to her, and everyone was just so helpful. The students especially wanted to get their story out. They felt that this was kept under wraps for some reason, and I think the only reason was nobody was ambitious enough to actually try to tackle this subject.
Well, you know, it's not like it was a turning point in history so much as it was an anomaly in history to get a band that would become as huge as The Who to be performing in literally the gymnasium of a Catholic high school.
Yeah, like a CYO, basically. Yeah. A CYO gig.
Before a crowd of less than 2,000 people, or thereabouts, I would say, right? Yeah. Ticket price is $250. Yeah, according to the cover, there it is, $250. Right. Donation. And The Who, we're only getting a fraction of that money as well. I mean,
$1,800.
That was their fee.
That was their take.
Now, I think just... Boy, times were different. When you think about, here
it
was.
Did that even cover their airfare?
I mean, think of really, at this point in time, the Beatles have already played at Shea Stadium twice, I believe, at this point in time. So now here's The Who. Like I said, they missed that whole British invasion thing, and there they are coming in much later. And they've got to really pay their dues by taking whatever gigs they could get. But you mentioned in the book, I remember something else about you talking about The Who playing a couple of gigs in New York City prior to playing at Union Catholic High School.
Right.
And the gigs that they played in the city were actually sparsely attended.
The Sunday matinee was sparsely attended, according to a good friend of mine. And they played three gigs at the Village Theater, which was the direct forerunner to the Fillmore East. That was the Fillmore East before it was the Fillmore East. They played Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I believe, or two Saturday shows and a Sunday matinee. That was Thanksgiving weekend. And then the following Wednesday, they played at Union Catholic. And you know where the show after that was? Never mentioned it in the book, but probably a place you've heard of, the Comac Arena.
Oh yeah,
that was the next
long
show.
Gone. Right. That's. I think I live about maybe 300 or 400 yards from where the Comac Arena used to be.
So there's no arena there.
Oh no, it's all like everything else. And these days, it's a strip mall. You know. That's kind of where Target is and King Cullen and all that stuff, right?
Oh, yeah,
where the
you keep
fork
on trying
is.
To point it out to me.
Yeah, that was a pretty dumpy place, but a good place for a show. And that's where The Who went afterward. The thing is, as weird as it is, I mean, as much as they must have been horrified to be walking into a Catholic high school to do their show. And imagine this now, The Who. This is Pete Townsend wrecking guitars, smashing instruments, Keith Moon being the loon that he is. And The Who are not the... I don't want to say they're bad boys, but they're certainly not,
they're not prim and proper.
Exactly.
Either.
So for them to be in a Catholic high school with certain expectations about what would be appropriate, you'd figure that they don't fit that bill at all. I mean, not even close. And yet there they are. in a packed room, and they must have ultimately been pleased to be there because the students managed to get the gymnasium. You know, they're playing before 2,000 people when they probably didn't have anywhere near that many people just the show before in New York City.
That's correct. They did fill the arena that night, and from all accounts, they were very pleased at the audience response.
Which was probably just sheer terror.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point because that was one of the questions that I was asking myself when I started the project was, you know, didn't the administration know that this was a group that would smash its instruments at the end of every show? And wasn't that, you know, against what this Catholic high school would, you know, stands for?
Or right, the Catholic mores, so that no, they're
I mean,
trying to...
So I was very curious about that. And I asked one of the faculty members, Joseph McMorrow, and he said, you know, he basically told me, look, if we had received complaints from parents, we would have canceled it. Truth is, no parents heard of them, so how would they have
canceled ahead of time? Yeah, there was no reason to.
And if they were known for doing something, things immoral, so maybe, you know, they would have canceled the show, but neither of those were the case.
But, I mean, it's hard for me to even conjure another band that could have been more controversial from 1967. I mean, of course, you could... I mean, Frank Zappa was probably... Okay, that would have been more controversial. but really, there's not very many
right.
that would be as in your face as far as pushing what the standard mores might have been, not only for the time, but for a Catholic high school, even one which was fairly libertarian or forward-thinking.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I can't think of another one. I mean, in the end, perhaps the last concert that Union Catholic held was Black Sabbath in 1971.
I remember reading that. That's ultimate. That's incredible. That's like inviting Satan into your front door almost,
right.
you know?
That's
right.
nuts.
Right. I don't know because I didn't do a book about that whole 4 or 5 year period, but that may very well have been the last concert that Union Catholic
that would have to have
staged.
Been the last. And it was the end of an era. I mean, you get to a point where you knew that it was going to end anyway. These bands. I mean, I can't think of how anything like that could happen in a contemporary circumstance right. at a high school. Let's play another track from Quadrophenia, and we'll continue talking with Michael Rosenboom. Right after one more song from the album. Let's play one of our favorites. I think you mentioned this is one of your favorites. I'm one, mine as well. So let's hear that track from Quadrophenia.
Those purple jeans, faded patch secrets of time.
All right, of course, that track is entitled I'm One, from an album that I think everybody in the room now agrees is our favorite. But one of our favorite bands, if not our absolute favorite album by one of our favorite bands, the album Quadrophenia by The Who. And, of course, also with us is Michael Rosenblum, who wrote this really, really cool book about The Who playing at a Catholic high school on November 29th, 1967. You know what's also really cool about this, Michael, as I'm going through this, you've even got photos of Pete and, you know, actually the band performing on the stage. Right. Actually, which is, stage is maybe a, it's a bunch of, like a loosely assembled stage, very small. You should tell the story about Roger Daltrey's reaction when he first walked into the gymnasium. I think I found that to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, Roger Daltrey was the first one to walk into the gym, and he immediately said, very curtly, stage too small, we can't play here. And, you know, the whole concert committee got really nervous that he meant what he said. And, you know, they ran to the principal and they were very worried. But in the end, it was just bluster and they probably needed that $1,800. And so they ended up playing.
Yeah, I mean, really, the choice is, yeah, they walk away from the fee completely or they go on with the show. Now, the thing is, that, you know, The Who didn't, Townsend in particular, didn't smash a guitar at every show that they played. I don't know what the ratio for when he did or didn't. I'm sure you've seen them often, so you could clarify that.
I think at that show, he was smashing it pretty much at every show. Pretty much. I would say 95% of the shows at that time. And then it got less. But there's a whole section in the book that talks about the guitar that he used.
Yes, yes.
You know, you mentioned that it's not a historic show, but there are some historic features about the show, and one of them is the guitar that he used, because it's the first time he ever used a Coral Hornet guitar. For those guitar aficionados,
was he using it because it was fairly inexpensive, and that it, when he. You wouldn't have to worry. Again, you wouldn't want to be smashed. I mean, a Gibson Les Paul would be tough to smash, first of all, because it's so heavy and like solid like a rock. But they're also incredibly expensive. You would want to be smashing up a guitar that could be worth thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I think this was more or less towards the end of the tour. He had been using a Gibson ES-335, I think. And finally, the last show at the Village Theater, he had just smashed it to smithereens. And he had, as a spare guitar, Leslie West had loaned him a guitar that was placed on the top of the amp just in case, which he never used.
I remember reading that was a brave thing for Leslie West to do.
Yeah. Maybe Pete paid him back by letting him play on Who's Next demos, you know, when you get the entire Who's Next CD, including demos. Leslie West is on some of those songs.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they had to do some shopping between Sunday, the day of the Village Theater show, and Wednesday, the day of the show at Union Catholic. So they went to Manny's, and you're right. They were looking for a guitar that wasn't too expensive.
That's Manny's Music in Manhattan, right?
Right. Yeah. And they ended up buying some Coral Hornet guitars, Vinnie Bell Signature Designs. And Vinnie Bell is... I guess was a well-known session man, session guitarist on the East Coast. He's the guy that plays in the background that guitar chick chick in Dionne Warwick's.
Walk on by.
Yeah. And that's the guitar he used for the first time. And you can see photos of his studio at home in the early 70s, and you can see some Coral Hornets hanging on the wall. Probably from that shopping session.
With you meeting the band that played before The Who, the Decoys, I'm just trying to, it's a bit of a fascinating thing because I guess it would have been anybody's high school fantasy to do what they did. You know, maybe when you're 50 or 60, you might think about it a little bit differently, but let's be honest, these guys are 15 or 16 years old and they're opening for The Who.
Right.
You know, I mean, and they were aware of who The Who were. These weren't some guys who just said, okay, well, the high school's going to be having some band come in. We'll open up for whoever it is. And then they discover they were aware of the Who. They were one of the few that were aware of what they were up against. How did they put this into context in terms of like what was happening at the moment?
Well, the first thing I would say is that when the, you know, playing, opening for the Who, you know, they had some Who songs in their repertoire, which, first of all, they wouldn't dare play, obviously.
Well, they were a cover band, essentially, right?
Right, yeah. They were a cover band, and so many were cover bands at the time. The one of the most amazing impressions I got from all these interviews was that everyone was in a rock band.
It was really the age of the garage rock movement. You know, the whole garage band thing was, you know, once the Beatles happened, let's face it, every single boy over the age of, or I should say under the age of 21, wanted to be in a band. So everybody started taking up instruments and learning to play.
That's right. And one of the reasons why I mentioned Bruce Springsteen three times in the book was because I didn't realize it until the last time that I, the last mention of him, which was a footnote about the Asbury Park, the Convention Center concert in July of 1967. One reason why I mentioned Bruce several times is because, in the end, he was the prototypical kid, musician, ambitious musician, trying to make it, who was knowledgeable about the Who at the time. Because from all of these interviews, as I said, I realized that so many people in the audience, so much of the audience was comprised of musicians who were knowledgeable about what was happening and knowledgeable about this band, even though the general public in America wasn't.
Well, that's an important point to make. Although the Who were playing in the gymnasium at Union Catholic High School, it wasn't like it was just the students of the school that were there. These tickets were sold publicly, so anybody could go who wanted to obtain a ticket.
Right. Yeah, I would say that about half or maybe two-thirds at most of the audience was students. And the rest was sold at record stores. You know, record stores were given an allotment of tickets to sell. They thought that the owners of the stores thought that it would increase traffic, you know, in their stores.
Right.
So they gladly sold the tickets.
Well, that would then be the knowledgeable portion of the audience,
that's
the people
right.
who knew who the Who were. I would imagine that with the ratio that you're talking about, that there would have been a lot of people who bought the tickets simply because they were supporting the school
right.
more than caring about seeing the show in particular. They probably didn't know who the Who were.
Right, and many of them were seeing a rock concert for the first time. So this was like their initiation rites to rock concert going. If you can imagine such a concert being your debut rock concert.
Yeah, right.
Pretty exactly.
Crazy. At this point in time as well. You talk a little bit about the audience reaction as the Who show begins to reach its climax, almost that sense of like too scared to clap. I'd love to have you talk about that because that fascinated me.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a picture in the book where one of the students is looking back and you can just read his mind saying, can you believe this? He's saying to someone sitting like five rows behind him. Yeah, I mean, everyone was stunned, basically, because although you've heard rumors that this is a show that smashes its instruments after every, this is a band that smashes its instruments after every show, when you see it, it's just very provocative, and it's totally new, something like this. You've never seen anything like this before. So there was stunned silence, and it wasn't until the show was over that there was a mad dash to the stage to pick up fragments.
Pieces of wood and such, yeah.
Right. Wow.
That's the difference, is that the Who were doing it deliberately while other bands, like, say, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles and such, would be getting rampaged and sometimes forced to leave their equipment on the stage where it would be destroyed because of a riot. You know, I know that's happened often. In fact, we'll be covering that on Friday with the Rolling Stones because that's pretty much exactly what was happening with them around 1965. The average Rolling Stones show probably lasted, you know, no more than 20 minutes. Now, the Who played for how long?
About an hour.
It was only about an hour, so it's still a fairly short show.
Yeah, that's what bands did that time.
Right. And yet, well, yeah, I guess I'm trying to think, because around that time, there was always those package shows where for a long time, bands would maybe be on tour
right.
with seven or eight other bands all on the same bill, or other acts, I should say. and they would maybe get allotted two songs, maybe three, and right, that would be it.
Right. I remember, and I mentioned it in the book, seeing the Jimi Hendrix Experience in April of 68, and he was headlining at Hunter College, and he only played for 45 minutes.
That's incredible, because with the nature of Hendrix's music, where he can, you know, go on, you know, basically he's a fantastic jammer, you know, as far as just doing things that are off the cuff. He could go on for 20 minutes on just Red House.
Right.
So to do an entire show that's only, you know, less than an hour, 45 minutes.
Yeah, but I don't remember feeling gypped.
No, I mean, just seeing, boy, you know, if
and
only.
And I was 14 at the time.
How many concerts would you say? I mean, I guess at that age, this is more, you were seeing a lot of shows at this point in time in your life.
Yeah, that's the year that I started to see rock concerts. So, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't remember how often I would go, but it would probably be two or three times a month I'd see a show. You know, The Who, I saw about 35 times between 1968 and 1975.
Right, the classic years. Yeah,
that's right, the Keith Moon years.
Right, exactly, the Keith Moon years, exactly. It's different now, yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of the Who shows afterward. You know, the Kenny Jones shows or the shows with Ringo's son,
right? Zach.
With Zach, right? And you know, of course, you know, the shows with Zach were great. I mean, seeing this album, Quadrophenia, I think they've done two separate tours performing Quadrophenia in its entirety. And I remember seeing one of them right here. I think it was at the Nassau Coliseum.
Right.
Maybe Madison Square Garden. I can't even, you know, something like that. Of course, this is where the Who belong. They're a, you know, they are
an arena,
a stadium
rock
band. Yeah, they're arena rock.
You know, Tom, you know your show on Friday, you know, how music
changed. Yeah, sure.
You know, I've always thought, or lately I've thought, that you can also do a few segments, a few shows on how the rock concert genre changed. And because, yeah, The Who you think of as an arena band, but this is a time when The Who were far from an arena band, just starting out in a small gymnasium, you know, and look how things changed there.
Right. They couldn't even, like you pointed out, they weren't even selling out the theater in Manhattan.
Right.
This, you know, pre-Bill Graham days. So that's another thing that's remarkably historical, that this goes back to that era. Just before the Fillmore East was even around.
Right.
Incredible. Let's play another song from Quadrophenia before we totally run out of time, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the book and this fascinating piece of history. And I'm so happy you wrote it to bring this to everybody's attention. And we'll talk, also remind me, let's do it right now. Where, if people want to find this, how can people get the book?
So you can purchase the book on Amazon. Type in When Stars Were in Reach, Michael Rosenblum, and it'll come up. You can also purchase it on my website, rosesblooming.com.
Rosesblooming?
Rosesblooming.com.
Nice.
You can get it there. You shouldn't have any problem finding it.
Good. That should work. Fantastic. One more track then from the album Quadrophenia. It's a little longer, but I love this track. Let's play I've Had Enough.
I ride a GS suit with my hair cut neat. I wear my wartime coat. taken all the high roads I've squandered and I've seen. I've had enough of childhood, I've had enough of graves. I've had enough of living, I've had enough of dying.
What's really great about this is we get to reminisce and play some of our favorite music. That's why I love this radio show. I get to basically just have fun, play some of my favorite music with no guilt at all. And to talk about it with people who are knowledgeable, or to my audience, who I really believe, I think I've got the smartest audience in rock and roll radio, because people, you know, really seem to react. We're getting a few phone calls already, just as we're, you know, basically, I haven't even given out the number, which is really nice because people are really appreciating your stories, Michael, and hearing the Who.
I appreciate telling them.
Now, you also met Pete Townsend a couple of times, right?
I did. I met him on two occasions. I also met John Entwistle once. That's not in the book. Yeah, in London in 1973, I was coming back from a year of study abroad. I met my friend who lives in England, Gordon Chilvers. And we went to the studio where the Who were mixing Quadrophenia. And they were actually mixing 515.
You just went there basically as a fan, hoping that you'd be able to see where this history was happening or something?
You know, subsequent to writing it, I actually remembered more than what I let on in the book. Gordon and I we actually, he knew Pete Townsend's address. I think it was to the embankment, right off the Thames. We actually knocked on his door. I can't believe how intrusive we were.
Well, but, at least it's not like what happened to Dylan in Woodstock. It's nowhere near that bad.
And his wife answered the door. And it was his wife who told us where the studio was.
Oh, my goodness.
Really?
Yeah, his dog Towser came out to the entrance of the door, and his wife answered and told us where the studio was. And we took the tube down to the studio, and they were mixing 515. They must have heard that song like 20 times until finally they took a break and Pete Townsend came out of the studio.
Now, what do you mean you heard it? I mean, you were outside of the studio listening to them?
Yeah, the studio was in this dilapidated area of London called Battersea. And it was in a red brick standalone building. And, you know, there were windows there. So, yeah, sound was coming out. And nobody was there except for my friend and I.
And are these live takes that you're hearing?
Except for my friend and me, excuse me.
Well, but are these live takes, or are they doing mixing, or are they actually trying to put down
track? No, these are not live tapes. They were doing mixing. They had already recorded it, and they were just mixing it to get a finished product.
Right.
And then Pete came out, and, you know, we introduced ourselves as fans and told him that I'm from the U.S., and he posed for a picture with us. And then that was the first time. The second time, when they did a week of concerts at Madison Square Garden, friends and I rented a hotel room in the hotel that they were known to always stay in on Central Park South. And Pete Townsend eventually didn't stay there. He stayed at the Hotel Pierre, and we called him. Somehow we got through. Don't ask me how. I don't remember a thing.
Either he's very accessible or you're just very lucky.
Well, we were persistent and lucky.
Well, I mean, his wife giving you the address for where they are, I mean, that's
incredible.
It sounds like he's very accessible in that regard.
I guess. And he let us in, like eight of us, into his hotel room in the Pierre. And we had like an hour conversation with him.
See what I mean? That's incredible.
And he was very, very nice both times.
He just let you into his hotel room and he just...
It seemed like he was actually bemused to be talking to these Who fans, because I think he recognized the faces, because these were fans that were always in the first few rows of all of his New York City concerts. And that doesn't explain why he let us in, because he didn't see us, obviously. But I think he actually saw it as an opportunity to meet some of his fans.
But you would imagine that would be something that he could do every day of his life, to the point where it would ultimately become not only redundant, but annoying.
Like, I guess at that point it wasn't. I don't know.
It's fantastic. Now, what year was that?
That was 73.
Around the time of Quadrophenia.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was... It was 73, 72. I think it was 73. Yeah.
That's just incredible. You know, because every time I see interviews with Pete Townsend, the first thing that I think of is that he's very reflective. He seems like somebody who really tries to give an honest, thoughtful answer to anybody who interviews him. He seems like he really appreciates a good conversation. And here he is, like, letting you guys in. And I guess he figures that you're intelligent enough or interested enough in his work that perhaps he found it stimulating on some level.
Yeah. First of all, he is one of the great spokesmen of rock.
Definitely, yes.
And let me just correct myself. That was 74 in Madison Square Garden, which explains it.
Even more incredible, though, yet.
Yeah, but, you know, what I found interesting was that he actually wanted to hear about us. It's strange. Like, each of us, he went around the room and each one gave a little story, you know, what you do. You know, he was actually interested. It was wild.
It's amazing. That makes me very happy. You know, when you find out things about people who are like your heroes and they turn out to be nice people, it's always such a pleasure. Because there's so many... No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, I can't say that, if I would have seen him a day later, he may have smashed a bottle over my head.
Well, we certainly know that he can be volatile. I mean, I don't know if he's Abby Hoffman's favorite person, for example, you know, because he kicked Abby Hoffman off the stage at Woodstock.
Oops.
Get off of my stage. And just booted him, literally, you know, booted him off. But, you know, the thing is, he's got his space and he... You know, controls it. It was in the middle of a show that Abbie Hoffman came out, so it was probably inappropriate for him to be getting political at that moment, and Pete thought as much, and so be it. And now that's one of those moments in history. But that's another story, because we're getting way ahead of ourselves. Because they well, here's a good point. That is less than 2 years forward from here when they were playing at Union Catholic High School.
That's right. Yeah, it's about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And look at the transformation.
Just in a year and a half, they're playing a high school gym in November of 1967, and then there they are playing at Woodstock in the summer of 69.
In front of half a million. And besides Tommy, it really was Woodstock that cemented their legacy in the U.S. And not even the concert as much as the movie, because the concert only half a million saw. But that movie, when they show him jumping, leaping with his guitar,
right,
in slow motion, and then right, everyone saw it. From then on, there was no turning back for the Who.
Well, are you saying the movie Tommy,
the movie Woodstock?
Woodstock, yeah. Right? The footage from him in Woodstock, right? With doing that crazy leg split jump,
right?
Which is now an iconic image,
right? And I know the show is slowly or quickly coming to an end, but that to me is the end of the '60s. That Woodstock movie, because prior to that, you didn't have to sleep out to get first row tickets.
No, exactly.
But after that, you had to.
Yeah, maybe days. Well, Mike, I don't know how we did it. That was an hour already. It felt like 12, 15 minutes, really, to be honest.
Time flies when you're having fun.
There's so much that we wanted to cover. And like I said, covering one album is nothing. The album and the book was quite a lot to do. But I want to thank you very much. I really enjoyed your company.
Thanks for having me. Can I add one thing before you close? I think you're going to be closing with a song that's a personal favorite of mine, and the song that the title of the book is taken from, When Stars and Reach. It's a quote from the song
Bellboy.
Bellboy. And it just, for me, fit on so many levels, because here were kids reaching for the stars, and the stars were within reach, and they had no idea where they would end up as adults. And also, these are stars, Townsend, Daltrey, Moon, and Entwistle, and they were within
reach. Of the highest
reach, regard. Within reach. The backstage was the teacher's lounge. So that's why I love this song personally. It means more to me now than it ever did.
Fantastic. Michael, thank you very much. It's been wonderful to have you as a guest. Hope everybody can join us next week as well, on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Or, of course, tune in on Friday as we continue our coverage of the Rolling Stones and the How Music Changed series. Take care, everybody. Here is Bellboy by The Who.
still sleep on the beach. Remember when stars were in reach. I wander in early to work. Spend my day licking boots for my perks.